I'm Greg Mangum, CEO and founder of Only a Pavement Away, the charity that supports people looking to rebuild their lives through employment opportunities and careers in hospitality. Today, Only a Pavement Away has placed over 650 people into work, adding an approximate value of $35 million back into society and the economy. Welcome to our podcast series, Serving Success, where we will be exploring how this amazing industry is truly driving change, supporting people who wish to rebuild their lives and add real value back into society. Each month we will be catching up with inspiring leaders who have put people and purpose at the forefront of their businesses and their business agendas. So without further ado, we're delighted to introduce this week's guest, Shireen Ritchie, former CEO of Buns From Home and Only a Pavement Away ambassador, who will be chatting with Mark Stretton, CEO and founder of Fleet Street.
Shireen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me on. I'm very humbled and excited to be here.
Excellent. Well, thank you. You strike me as someone who is a real champion of people in this industry. Can you tell us why?
I think I massively am. If I'm known for anything, if my legacy is anything, I really want it to be champion people. So just a little bit about me and my background. When I was younger, I wanted to be an actress. That was a plan. And I used to bunk off school and I used to go to Pineapple Dance Studios and do like lessons there. Before it was trendy and anyone knew who it was just the best place to dance. So I would bunk off school, go to Pineapple Studios, and then they put the prices up. So my mum was working three jobs. She was a one-parent mum. She literally couldn't afford to feed us both on some nights. So I couldn't ask my mum for any more money. So I was like, right, I need to go and get a job. So I went to TGI Fridays and I walked in and I was like, look, I'm only 15. I'm going to be honest, I'm only 15. But I'll work really, really hard. I just need to earn a little bit of money to pay for my dance lessons. And back in the day, then you could do cash in hand work. So at 15 years old, I got given my first job at TGI Fridays, working cash in hand 2 days a week. And that was how my journey began in this industry. And I come from the wrong side of town. So my background, if you go all the way back, my biological father was very, very violent. So my mum was almost like captive in the house. And yeah, as I say, I have memories of him. I wouldn't change my childhood for me. I changed it for my mum. Yeah. But yeah, he was really violent. And what actually happened is there had been a new suite released. So my mum would be timed. The only time she'd be allowed to leave the house was to take me to school and pick me up from school. So she had been timed and picked me up from school. And I always remember I had to be first out. Like I was programmed. I had to be first out and we just left.
Just because the stress and pressure that she was under.
Because if she got back late, he would beat the living daylights out of her for being 20 seconds late. Like, it was not a normal relationship. He was a very toxic, troubled man. And mum was in this terrible, toxic relationship that she couldn't get out of. She had no friends, no family. She wasn't allowed to speak to her family over the years. And it got to the point that the only time she could leave the house was to go. And I remember leaving school, and there was some new suite that was out or something, and everyone was going to the newsagents, and you had to walk past the newsagents to get to my house. And I remember crying to mum, going, you never let you out. We never go. You never let me get any sweets. Everyone's going, please, mummy, please, please, please. And she's like, right, okay. And I remember being in there and picking up this sweet, and there was this massive queue. And my mum literally freaking out, like shaking, going, what's going on? Everyone needs to hurry up. And I remember thinking, calm down, mum. It's a queue. You know, and I'm trying to talk to my friends. And I remember my mum literally fumbling. She couldn't get her money out. She's like nearly crying. And anyway, we ended up getting home and like we're running home and I'm like, hang on a minute, mum, and I've got my bags hanging off of me. And we're running home. And as we got to the door, I remember the door being open and my father standing there. And literally as we got in the house, he literally just knocked her out and just started beating. And I then remember going, okay, this is my fault. And I remember like trying to stop him and going, no, it was my fault. And he was saying all sorts of crazy accusations. And then she wasn't allowed to leave the house. So I had someone take me to school, pick me up from school. And on my 7th birthday, he had said to her, like, basically, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to murder you. And I'm going to take Shireen to Egypt. And no one will ever see her again. And we're going to Egypt. And bags were packed. I think he had flight tickets. And like, it was a real thing. So my mum wrote in lipstick on toilet paper to call, like, 999 at 7 p.m. because it was my birthday. And it was my birthday party. And he said, you can have the birthday party with Shireen. And then you'll never see her again, and that's that. So she passed it over to the neighbour. She'd got outside in the garden, and she'd thrown it over the fence to the neighbour who was out there. And luckily, they'd read it, and they'd called the police. So I had my birthday party, and there's a picture of me at my birthday party, and my mum looks actually very happy. She's smiling, and yeah, it was about 30 minutes later. It was a photo before everyone left, and about 30 minutes later, all the police turned up, and it got into a bit of a hostage situation. Mum got out, but I was under the table with a cat because he always said he would kill my cat, Tiddles. So I was trying to protect the cat. Police were in. He was fighting the police officers. Mum was out there screaming for me. They wouldn't let her back in. So, and this went on for hours, hours and hours and hours. There was TV crews at this point. So, yeah, and eventually we got out, and then my mum contacted her mum, who she hadn't seen in years, and was like, we've got nowhere to go. So we went to my nana's, and then we ended up going into the care system for a while, and that was quite challenging. Again, not challenging for me, but challenging for my mum. And, you know, she always put such a brave face on it. She still is the strongest person I know. And I mean, the greatest gift my mum ever gave me was telling me that I could change my stars. I think I really have. And I think just going back to, sorry, in a very long-winded way, going back to the question around why people are so important is people invested in me. So my old boss was someone called Jason Cotter, who used to be managing director of Oldenstein. He's now currently at Itsu. And Jason, bless you, Jason, if you're listening. I mean, I talk about him a lot. He's very, very humble around it. But he put up with a lot. I was like a nightmare of a teenager. I really was. I was a pain at times. And he just invested so much into me. He put up with, you know, the challenges, you know, the tantrums. I remember once I didn't get, you know, something that I wanted in work. And I thought it was massively wrong and I knew everything. So I stormed out and said, I quit, I'm going, you know. And he was like, come back in, have a cup of coffee. You don't quit, don't be silly. You know, the dramatic teenager that I was. I did a lot of growing up in TGI Fridays. But our industry saved me. You know, there were real parts in my later teens. And I think that's why I resonate so much with Only a Pavement Away. And when Greg says, we called it Only a Pavement Away because everyone is only a pavement away, I resonate with that so much because there were so many times where I was only one bad decision from my life being very, very different. And I just think humans are incredible. I think we are incredible machines. I think it's so important to look after each other. And this industry, what makes us special is how we can take someone like me and they can become a CEO of a business like Buns from Home. I didn't have any education. I mean, I had a Duke of Edinburgh Award. I'm very proud of my Duke of Edinburgh Award. I was talking to my son about this, actually, and he's like, what's a Duke of Edinburgh Award? I couldn't really remember. I just remember walking a lot. I just remember I had to walk.
With a heavy bag.
With a bag forever. But, you know, I didn't have any qualifications. I was a bit of a troubled kid. You know, I come from the wrong side of town. I'm still living in the wrong side of town. My mum was doing her best just to keep a roof over our heads and try and teach me good morals and how to be a good person. And then I joined Fridays. And, I mean, I say it now, I bleed red and white. I mean, I was at TGI Fridays for nearly 10 years and I did a lot of growing up in the brand. And when I left, it was time for me to leave. But I will never, ever, ever take that kindness for granted. And I will always pass it back. And it's a huge responsibility as a leader. If I've got, I always used to say this at Leon, if I've got 2,500 people working for me, that's 2,500 people that whether they stay in this industry or not, what we do makes a difference. It makes a difference if they get that Saturday night off to go to their mum's birthday party. Because you don't know, you know, I remember a situation that someone was like, you can't have your mum's birthday party off. And they were crying. And I was like, look, let's try and work it out. And then they pulled me aside and they were like, she won't get another one. She's dying. And I was just like, if we hadn't have taken the time to have spoken to this person, they probably would have just come into work and have missed their mum's last because that was the human that they were. They were quite introverted. They didn't really want to argue with authority. They wanted to do a good job and do what they were told. Now, that's a very extreme situation. Not everyone that wants a Saturday night off is for such an extreme situation. But it raises the importance of everything you do as a leader. Right? It makes a difference to so many people. And that's a lot of responsibility. And you don't always get it right. But people are everything. People are everything. And I would do anything to champion people. I would do anything to give someone a chance. Because that's what people did for me.
Why is it that you think you've been successful? And you've already kind of answered it because you can just hear your passion for people. I imagine you're great at nurturing and coaching people. But I'll stop answering the question. Tell us, why do you think you've been successful?
Oh, I think because I've had amazing mentors. I mean, I do mentor now, and I think it's so important to give back. And I want to make a difference. And I think there's still a lot that can be done. And we can work on the greatness that has already, you know, been created in our industry. But I had so much support. And I think it's just my mum telling me that I can do it. I've got a very positive natural attitude anyway. I think I was born quite positive. I'm very operational. I'm a fixer. So if something happens, I'm like, how do we fix this? So like even when my mum's had stage 4 cancer twice now. And I'm like, how do we fix this, mum? There's got to be an old Google. And it's just probably my coping mechanism. But I'll be like, you know, what are anti-carcinogenic foods? What can we do? What is good? Where can we go? Who can we speak to? I'm always looking to fix something. So when I think that drive in me, and I have got natural drive, I like socialising, I like being around people, I like learning things. I always want to be better. I always want to develop myself. I want to be a better person for the people that I lead. I want to be a better person for my children, for my husband, for my family, for my friends. I want to be better all the time. Every time I do even something like this, I'll leave and I'll be like, oh, I should have said this or I should have said that. I'd always look at what could I do to improve. And I think that's important. I think when you as a human are like, oh, I've got all the answers, I know everything. I'm not an egotistical person, I don't think. And I think that's quite important for my journey because I've always been so keen to learn and so keen to put my hand up and help. And I've met some amazing humans along the way that, again, I wouldn't be where I am if it wasn't for a whole host of people. Mm. And I remember Anne Elliott years ago contacted me and saying, hey, my name's Anne Elliott. And I heard you talk and maybe let me help you out because it was really awful. She was very polite. It was really awful. And we started talking and Anne sort of is now still a mentor. She can't get rid of me. And she's very kind. We do stuff together now. But, you know, there was lots of people like that in the industry that really reached out and gave me time.
And just about being a leader, you seem very natural, very from the heart, very sort of positive personality. But I suspect you've also done a lot to develop yourself as a leader. What have you done to kind of educate yourself and develop yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Even down to, I mean, I'm massively dyslexic. So I've always worked on that. I've always tried to do, there's different techniques you can do. There's different systems. When it comes to really understanding yourself and how you can best lead, I read books. I've got some amazing mentors. One thing that really stands out, I've spent probably the last 15 years working for founders. Now, working in a founder-led business is different to working in a bigger corporate business. Founders are absolutely amazing. They are creative geniuses, and I've learned stuff that I never would have learned in a corporate business. And I'm not very corporate. Anyone that's met me will know that I'm not very corporate. But also, there is sometimes challenges because founders don't tend to be CEOs. They're different skill sets. Now, there's a book called Founders Mentality by Jimmy Allen. And in 2018, I was very fortunate that Jimmy mentored me for a while. And that was really amazing. And he gave me some really great techniques and I moved on for that. And I just think being around people that you identify with. Now, I can only lead in the way that I lead. If I try and take on other people's leadership styles, which I've done previously, I've seen amazing people that potentially are introverts or that potentially are very blue when you look at the insight spectrum. Mm. And I'm not very blue. So, and I'll try and lead like them because I'm impressed and I'm like, I want to almost mimic what they do. And then you foul because you can't mimic what someone else.
Isn't it?
It's impossible. You've got to lead in a way that you lead. And I think I'm quite a realistic person. I always speak quite honestly. It's probably my best quality and my worst quality, if I'm being honest, is my honesty. But people tend to, because it comes across as authentic, you've got to be your authentic self. And my authentic self is trying to inspire people. And I'm always a big believer in getting people to want to do it rather than telling them they have to do it. You know, yes, you have to clean the dishwasher. No one wakes up and wants to clean the dishwasher, right? No one wants to, especially when you've done, you know, a 20 grand shift in La Sagrada's RFH. Who wants to clean the minging dishwasher? But if you can get them in a way to understand the part that they play in the bigger story, they'll want to do it. And that they're, you know, they're the bigger cog in the wheel. It's like the story where, you know, putting the man on the moon,
yeah,
isn't it?
And he's
sweeping.
Yeah,
and he's sweeping. And he's like, oh, you're sweeping the floor. He's like, no, I'm helping to put a man on the moon. It's getting that. And I really, because I buy into that. I think that's so important. You know, I didn't get where I am today just all by myself. Certainly not. No one creates greatness all by themselves. Mm. You know, so you're doing it all together and getting people to come on the journey and looking after people and asking people what they want. You know, especially we're doing benefits at the moment with Buns. And I don't know what an 18-year-old wants. I'd like to think that I'm cool and trendy. Mark, I'm absolutely not cool and trendy. I have no idea. So let's, you know, so asking what people want and not assuming. Because actually what people want nowadays and what the younger generation want is very, very different to what I wanted at 18 years old. You know, it's very, very different. It's a different world now. So I think you have to be nimble. You have to be agile in your mindset. You cannot be set in your ways.
And I think you are also someone who talks to being a female leader in hospitality and addressing those gender imbalances that we still encounter, especially at a senior level.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. And I've heard you speak passionately for other imbalances as well. Why do you do that?
Yeah, because life isn't fair, okay? We grew up watching Disney movies. There is no knight in shining armour coming to save us, right? We save us. But we need some help along the way. So within the fabrics of our society, there is a fundamental bias. There is a problem, you know, be it, you know, against females, against race, against disability. There is a fundamental issue, not in our industry, not in our country, in our world, that there is a fabric of DNA woven that is a bias. And that's not okay. And I have a real issue. Life isn't fair, and I'm aware of that. But it doesn't mean I'm okay with it. It doesn't mean I like things being unfair. But I think it's such a huge subject, and I think it's ingrained in us so much. But I talk a lot about what we need to do as an industry, but also when I mentor females, and we do a lot of amazing industry events that are led by some amazing humans in this industry, male and female, of all abilities, of all races, you know, really trying to shine a light to get more females, you know, to get more people of colour, to get more people of disability onto boards and into leadership roles. Getting them into the industry is less of a problem. Getting them into the leadership roles is where we seem to struggle. And we talk about this a lot, about, you know, what are the reasons? And when I mentor people, we go to these amazing events and they leave and they're like, yeah, I'm going to take the world and I can do this. And then 2 weeks later, they're just back in their day-to-day life. And when I mentor a lot of females and a lot of people of colour, the question I get is, what do I do day-to-day? Now, you can't change what other people do. You can try and guide them. You can try and push them in the direction that you'd like them to go. But the only thing you can actually control is what you do. You can control how you think. You can control the decisions that you make. You know, there's a stat out there that I think if there's a job description and if a male meets around 40% of it, he'll apply for the job. Now, if a woman on the same job description meets around 80% of it, she'll phone a friend, set a WhatsApp group up, ask all of her mates, should I do it? They'll push her. She maybe have a glass of wine and she might apply. Mm. Now, whose fault is that? You can't blame the man. You know, for applying, it's inwards. And yes, for the society that we grew up in and what you're taught and subliminal messages. And there's an amazing book called Invisible Women by Caroline Perez. And it's about exposing data bias in a world designed for men. And it's an amazing book. And there is definitely something to it. But again, on a day-to-day basis, it's about looking inwards. It's about how can we get more females, more people of colour, to be more confident? How can we get them to apply for the jobs? How can we get them to see their brilliance? How can we get them to put themselves forward? And then you have the point of when, you know, we have amazing chairs. I think I can name maybe 5 or 6 female chairs in our industry. How do we get them champion, you know, and when they're setting, you know, directors and CEOs, how do we get them looking at the skill sets? And it's okay that male and female do have different skill sets. You know, women can be more empathetic. You know, it isn't about women trying to take on a man's trait or a male trait. Or, you know, that certainly isn't it. It's about that there's room for both of us. We need both male and female, right? You need both genders to be able to flourish. It certainly isn't one or the other. It's just about seeing a balance. And there is an imbalance. You know, when you look at the gender pay gap, it's gone the wrong way. It went 1% the wrong way last year. So, like, we need to work on that as an industry. And I take that responsibility very serious. And it isn't just in the brand that I work in. It's that I have a voice. I get to do amazing things like this. I get invited on podcasts. People ask me to speak. So I just think I've got a duty of care to the industry to really try and, you know, make people think about how we can all help support each other. A lot of it isn't intentional. It's unconscious bias. Once you make it aware, you can then work on it.
And I think diverse teams in all senses make for much better teams and much more rounded teams. I think it was Paul Pavley talking on the Only a Payment Away, and we'll get into this a bit more in a bit, but he was talking on their recent 5-year anniversary video about how people that have gone through hardships and tough times, they tend to bring a lot to teams, And we also need to think of diversity in that sense as well.
Absolutely, 100%. Like, I just think what Only Pavement Away do, as I said earlier, it really resonates with me. But there are some amazing people. Again, just because you made a bad decision and you have spent some time in prison, or you've made a bad decision and you've ended up homeless, that doesn't define you, right? What you do defines you. No one makes perfect choices. There is not a human in the world. So everyone needs to get off of their high horse, right? Because there is no perfect humans. Just because you have MD or CEO or chair in your name, it doesn't make you any more special than someone that potentially sleeping rough. It just makes you slightly more fortunate. You can maybe help that person. It also means you don't have all the answers. I'm sure we'll get onto that in a moment. But it's industry, but there's so many amazing humans that have hit hard times that if you give them some time, if you give them a chance, they'll be the next CEO, they'll be the next leader, they'll be the next marketing manager of Popeyes, you know, they'll be the next big thing. And that's, again, why our industry is great. And more people, and I know Hilton do an amazing job with Only Pavement Away. I was very fortunate enough to meet some people that have been on the Only Pavement Away process, and they worked at the Hilton. And they were amazing. I literally, very little silences me. Mark, you've met me a few times now, you know that. There's not a lot that will make me be quiet. And I remember just sitting there in awe, them talking about their journey. And one of them had started as a KP and had worked their way up to sous chef. And another lady was working in events and she just loved talking to people. And like her role at events was just making sure everyone was happy. And you could just see that was so important and it almost become their life and they loved it and it was their motivation. And that's so special. And that's why Only Pavement Away is so important at doing stuff like that. But I think as an industry, we all need to embrace that. You know, just because someone has come from the wrong side of town, it isn't a bad thing. Actually, it could be the best choice you ever make.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to ask you about something you wrote recently, which I think was in Propel.
It was, yes.
About it was called The Curse of the Strong.
Yes, which is a book by Dr. Tim Cantopa.
Okay. All of those opinion editorial style articles are brilliant, but some are more brilliant than others. And I think the ones that really leap off the page are where someone's really got something to say. But tell us, what did you want to say and why did you write that?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you. So it was a weekend. And I'd had a challenging conversation with my founder, which is okay because you have challenging conversations with boards and founders, nothing wrong in that. I'll be honest, I was having a glass of wine and I was just watching my kids play. And I was just sort of thinking back to a time at Leon, and then something on the radio had come on that it was Mental Health Awareness Week. And I was like, I didn't even realise it was Mental Health Awareness Week. And I just started to think about the book, Curse of the Strong. So what I'm certainly, my superpower isn't teaching on the book, but it's an amazing concept. And the very first time I heard about it was Steve Head was talking at Leon. And we would do a session four times a year. So every single team member at Leon, no matter what you was employed as, every single team member got to go to Eat Well, Live Well and hear Steve Head talk. And he spoke on Curse of the Strong. And basically what Curse of the Strong is, it's a concept that suggests individuals who are perceived as strong, capable, resilient, often face unique challenges and pressures precisely because of these qualities. Due to this, high expectations are placed on them. They're expected to handle more responsibility, solve problems on their own, always perform at a consistently high level. They have a lack of support, I would say. Maybe they have a lack of support because they're perceived as self-sufficient people. They're the people that are actually less likely to reach out for help. And everyone assumes they're okay. No one says, are you okay? Because you're the strong one. And it's normally people that go to them, and others will often share their own emotional burdens, you know, and how you feel obliged, right? It's a strong human. If someone shares, you feel obliged, okay, I'm going to be strong for this person. I'm going to help because you always want to help, right? And everyone assumes that they're okay. So their own vulnerabilities and emotions to maintain their image of strength, you know, and the worst of all is they won't ask for help. Because that will be perceived as weakness. It will be perceived as, oh, it might undermine their reputation of being strong. If I are, oh, you know, everyone thinks I'm strong and that I'm this badass leader. If I ask for help, that's going to be ruined and everyone's going to think I'm a weak person. And I just think when I was writing it, I was like, does that sound familiar? And then it just took me through to a time in my life. And I always listened to the story. I'd heard Steve Head talk maybe 10, 15 times, and I loved it. And in the parts I could say it like word for word of what he was going to say and what was coming up next. And Curse of the Strong, really, I sort of listened to it, but I didn't really understand it. I thought I understood it. And then in 2020, obviously COVID had hit, which was a challenging time for everyone. I was a new mum. I was currently going through a CVA with Leon. We were working on that in the background at the time. No one knew. And it was a challenging CVA because CVAs tend to be slightly easier. Not that CVA is ever easy or anything anyone ever wants to do. But if you have got lots of creditors that aren't landlords or HMRC, it makes it easier. And we had none of that. We'd really tried to pay everyone, you know, and we worked with lots of mum and pop businesses and lots of little suppliers. And that was always our ethos. So we didn't want to stitch anyone over, but we couldn't continue as we were. So we're going for a challenging CVA because most of our creditors was HMRC or landlords. And then my mum had got sick. She had been looking after my son and we thought it was appendicitis. She fell to the floor, called an ambulance. She got rushed in and it turned out she had bowel cancer. So it spread. It was quite a big tumour that had burst. It spread to her kidneys and she had to go in for an operation. And they'd said to me, I'd rushed to the hospital, they'd said to me, look, it's 20% chance at best that your mum's going to survive. And I remember my mum trying to say goodbye to me. So this is the second time she's had stage 4 cancer. She's trying to say goodbye to me. And I'm just like, no, we are not doing this. And I'm like talking about, no, you're going to go in, it'll be fine. I'm going to do is I'm going to go to Greg's, I'll get a sausage roll, I'm going to get us some food. I'm going to go somewhere and it's going to be fine. I'll be here with food when you're back and I'm going to have your coffee. You'll be fine. You'll be able to drink coffee. You'll be all right. And
so
I was like,
pushing that whole conversation
wouldn't
away.
Have it. And I remember getting in the lift after mum had gone in. I walked right to the operating theatre with her. She's hysterical and I wouldn't engage. And she's just screaming at me that she loves me. And I remember getting in the lift and just not a lot of tears, but just a few tears thinking I've really messed up. I've really messed up. I might not see my mum again and I didn't say goodbye. And I remember starting to feel quite panicked. So I just walked to the car, sat in the car and I froze. Not figuratively, I literally froze. Couldn't speak, couldn't think, didn't move, just sat there. And it must have been around 7 hours. It was around 7 hours that I was sat there. And it was almost like a hypnosis that my mind had put me into to protect my mental state. And 7 hours later, I came around, sat in the same position, went into the hospital quite dazed. I had to wait another hour or so before she was out of the operation and she survived and life continued. But I was never the same after that. And I remember going home that night, didn't tell my husband about it. It was very, very quiet. Obviously, it was just with my baby. And then over time, I'd love to say, and I wrote this, I'd love to say that I changed my ways completely, that I started to ask for help, that I shared my story with everyone and that, you know, I said no to more things, that I was less fearful of decisions that I'd make. None of that happened. But I did talk a little bit more to people that I trusted and I did let my guard down. And I think part of my areas of development and from where I come from, I've always been quite guarded. You know, I'm always smiley, very happy. You know, you won't see me cry. You won't really ever see me angry. I'm just quite, I internalise all of that and then try and deal with it in my own way. And I think out of that, I started to show vulnerabilities. I remember going on a call with Charlotte DiCello, who was our chief commercial officer, and I broke down in tears. And I remember her literally just, she didn't know what to do. But she was like, I'm so grateful because then she's having a hard time and she's crying. And we were both like crying at 10 o'clock at night. We were doing Feed NHS at the time, Feed Britain. There was a huge amount of, we felt a huge amount of responsibility. You know, we're trying to feed 101 hospitals through 12 different hospital trusts. And obviously a huge amount of people were doing this. It wasn't just us and Leon doing this. But there was a lot going on and we got ourselves through together. But it really shone a light for me on mental health. Now, I think I'd always thought, probably subconsciously, that you either had mental health issues or you didn't. You were either born with it and it was a chemical imbalance and you forever needed to have medication to treat that chemical imbalance. And then I really understood that mental health issues, they can be temporary, you know, and it's known as situational depression. Mm. And that's what it's known as. And because we are only humans, we are all machines. Even the best car in the world, if you run a Ferrari, you know, that costs you £1 million, if you run it and run it and run it, eventually, and you don't look after it and you don't, you know, do what you should do, it's going to break down. It doesn't matter that it's £1 million Ferrari and it's the best car in the world. It's going to break down. And humans are like that. And I think that understanding that it doesn't make me weaker, it makes me stronger. So when I wrote this piece, I wrote it in the sense of, I just want to help someone. It's National Health, you know, Mental Health Awareness Week. And if anyone was ever going through what I went through, even if I didn't know them, I would just want to help them. It's very much, as I say, my nature. I just want to help people. I just want to be a positive force. I just want to do good things. And I was like, maybe I'll write something. And again, I'm hugely dyslexic. I hadn't written anything, honestly, since I was 6 years old. You'll understand if you read the piece. And I then sent it to Paul, editor of MD of Propel. And he rang me straight away. And I was like, oh, he's probably ringing me to be like, oh, Shireen, thanks so much.
Letdown.
But do you know what? You're great at so many things, but this probably isn't one of them. And I was like, ah, hey, how you doing? And then he was like emotional. And he was like, Shireen, I'm taken aback. I don't quite know what to say. I'm almost like, feel like I need to wipe tears away. And he was quite emotional. And I was shocked. I didn't even know what to say. I think I just was like, oh, okay, thanks. And then I put the phone down.
Mm.
And then Mark Wingett had messaged me a couple of hours later and said, I've just read it. Oh, my goodness. And I was like, well, look, yeah, of course you can put it out. And they were like, thank you for being so brave. And I never wrote that thinking I was brave. I never wrote that thinking, oh, I'm you know, I just wanted to help people. And the amount of leaders and people that I had yet to have the pleasure of meeting within this industry that reached out to me really from the Friday to the Monday on that piece, it's breathtaking. And I feel humbled that people have read it and it's made a difference. And there was one massive leader that had, no one knows, had recently had a mini stroke. And they reached out to me and said, you know, I've recently had a mini stroke and you've really helped me and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And I was just like, wow, that's the difference, you know, that humans can make.
Thank you very much for coming on. Thank you very much for being such a champion of all sorts, of all of the ground that you've covered, and for speaking out about some of the things that you speak out about. And, yeah, I guess we're off to Buns from Home.
We're off to Buns from Home. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Shireen.
Have a lovely day.
Thank you so much for listening. A huge thank you to our guest, Shireen, this week's host, Mark Stretton, and, of course, our sponsors, Brewdog and Stonegate, who without them, this wouldn't have been possible. Please do give us a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, to be sure you never miss an episode. Remember, without your support, we couldn't do what we do, and we want to do more. So keep your ears and your eyes peeled for next month's episode. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon.